Welcome to Crisis Management. I'm Alicia Sikorska. On today's episode, Alberta is introducing a proof of vaccination system as it grapples with surging cases of COVID-19 and stresses on the healthcare system. We will discuss Premier Kenney's response and how businesses have reacted to this new proof of vaccination plan. And we are closing in on the end of the federal election campaign with just 4 days before Canadians head to the polls. We'll take a look at how the 2021 campaign has unfolded and how it has shaped up over the last 33 days. Now, to get through all this, I'm joined by Sean Spear. Sean is a fellow in residence at the Public Policy Forum. He previously served as senior economic advisor to Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and he is here to help us unpack the policy issues brought forward by COVID-19. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Alicia.
So let's kick things off with an update on the COVID-19 situation in Alberta. The province is grappling with a fourth wave, unlike any that we are seeing in other provinces across Canada, with cases skyrocketing at a pace of more than 1,000 cases per day. Intensive care units are filling up, and thousands of non-urgent surgeries have had to be canceled. On Wednesday evening, Premier Jason Kenney responded to this fourth wave. He declared a state of public health emergency, reintroducing some of the restrictions that he had lifted just a few months earlier. He also announced that the province is going to be introducing a proof of vaccination system, something he had previously resisted due to concerns over privacy rights. Now let's take a listen to what Premier Kenney had to say about his government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Based on our analysis of other jurisdictions around the world with similar rates of vaccination, we believed that we could prudently move away from addressing COVID as a pandemic and towards an endemic. It is now clear that we were wrong, and for that, I apologize. Jurisdictions all around the world have been learning how to deal with this ever-changing threat to human life. Often that has been a process of trial and error. I know that we all want certainty and predictability during these difficult times. But one thing we've learned about COVID is that it simply is not predictable.
He's certainly right about that. But Premier Kenney's response to the pandemic has at times diverted from what we're seeing from other premiers in provinces across this country. Sean, what do you make of the last 24 hours in Alberta and Premier Kenney's response to the fourth wave?
There's so much to be said, Alicia. I think what is striking, of course, is how yesterday's message, both with respect to the adoption of vaccine passports, as well as the reintroduction of various public health restrictions, diverges from the messages that we've heard from the Alberta government for the past several weeks and months. Viewers will know that it wasn't that long ago that the Calgary Stampede was in full effect. And various other economic and social activities that were all part of what Mr. Kenney described as the best summer ever. And I think what we saw yesterday is a kind of extraordinary acknowledgement that those choices were wrong and have forced the province now back into a set of lockdowns that that are more stringent than anywhere else in the country. So, you know, we could talk a bit about what the causes are behind this spike in cases in Alberta. We can talk a bit about, you know, the political fallout of these choices. But I think at just the high level, you know, people are no doubt struck by just the kind of 180 that the Alberta government has adopted with respect to COVID-19. And I think that is leading to a lot of confusion amongst businesses and regular Albertans.
Before we get into that business reaction, because I do think there is a lot of confusion coming from business groups about this new system, I do want to touch on, you know, how we got here and how Alberta ended up being in this position where cases are increasing by the 1,000 per day.
Well, as Premier Kenney acknowledged yesterday, that progress on vaccinations in the province have underperformed other parts of the country. And what's notable about that is it's not a consequence of lack of supply or even some of the incentives that the Alberta government has experimented with. It seems like there's a larger share of the Alberta population that is resistant two vaccines. It sounds like on overall terms, the province is only a handful of percentage points off the national average, but that obscures some parts of the province, Alicia, where the vaccination rate is less than 50%. And we know enough about the virus and the current variants that those conditions, relatively high levels of unvaccinated people, is essentially a breeding ground for exponential growth. And so, I think we've talked in the past, Alicia, that that Premier Kenney has adopted what might be described as kind of a libertarian approach to this, placing a lot of onus on people's personal responsibility to get through the crisis. And I think what we saw yesterday, in effect, is a kind of education of Jason Kenney himself, an acknowledgement that a kind of libertarian response to something like this pandemic is simply not going to work, especially in a province where, for various kind of cultural reasons and other factors, there just seems to be more mistrust and reticence about vaccinations than we've seen elsewhere, including, for instance, in Ontario, where notwithstanding big mistakes on the part of the government, the public seems more prepared to follow public health advice and get themselves vaccinated.
It's interesting on that vaccination rate. In order to reopen back in the summer, the government had outlined a 70% vaccination rate. It's different from what approach we saw here in Ontario, where it was mandated that by individual health boards that they, no health board or health unit could be below a certain threshold. So I believe it was 75%. Whereas what you're seeing when you look at the numbers in Alberta right now is that, yes, they have an overall rate of about 71%, but there are regions within the province that are much lower and around that 40% mark. But Sean, do you think in that messaging of the best summer ever and the change and the shift from pandemic to endemic, that may have had an impact on the need or the ability of encouraging more people to get vaccinated, that it may have actually discouraged some people who were perhaps hesitant from going to get vaccinated, given that life was returning back to normal in the province?
Yeah, it's a fascinating observation. I think there's probably something to that, that by, effectively taking the foot off the gas, it contributed to a kind of sense of complacency amongst the population. I think that's a really insightful comment, Alicia. I would just say more, to step back for a second for non-Albertans who are tuning in, I think it's worth unpacking the kind of political dynamic in Alberta. Jason Kenney governs a kind of center-right coalition. There are some members of his caucus who would be described as very conservative, I think, probably more conservative than the kind of typical conservative politician in other parts of the country. And so he's really been squeezed from kind of both sides of the political spectrum over the course of this pandemic. There's been calls, of course, for more stringent measures from the left side of the spectrum, and then a major opposition to public health restrictions amongst that conservative base within his caucus. And I think, trying to balance these competing views has led Mr. Kenney down this path, which, as he acknowledged yesterday, was a mistake. And so I think, one of the key lessons here is that when you're facing a crisis like the one we're living through, you can't afford to be making these compromises trying to navigate the political terrain. You have to go with, the best option available to you and just live with the political fallout. Because, as you know better than anyone, Alicia, what the net result here is, there's just been this extraordinary gap between the expectations that Mr. Kenney set and the outcome. And in the world of politics, raising expectations and failing to meet them is political kryptonite.
Yeah, and an interesting aspect is that in the press conference, something that struck me at least was Kenney really avoided referring to this proof of vaccination system as a vaccine passport. He's calling it a restriction exemption program. And there's a further clarity that businesses are looking for when it comes to how this policy will be enforced and kind of the burden that it does place on businesses. But do you see that squeeze that's coming from certain pockets within Kenny's caucus as the reason why this proof of vaccination system is different from what we're seeing, at least slightly different from what we're seeing in places like Ontario and Quebec, where there are no kind of accommodations for the unvaccinated that want to go into indoor dining, that it's just a slightly different program? Is that how you see that?
Yeah, I'd say two things in response to this question. Just first on your specific question, I think the short answer is yes. You know, there's been speculation for days, weeks that we were going to see a mass exodus from the caucus, even possibly the cabinet in response to the reintroduction of some of these stringent public health measures. So, you know, there's no doubt that Mr. Kenny has been sensitive to that, including with respect to vaccine passports or whatever the government is choosing to call them. The second thing I'll say, you know, at the risk of sounding like I'm doing a bit of a victory lap here, I've made a lot of wrong predictions over the course of these episodes during the pandemic. But I think one that we've gotten right on this show is the inevitability of the adoption of vaccine passports. At various times, governments across the country have resisted, including in Ontario and Alberta. And we kept saying on the show that that those governments were ultimately going to have to give in. That the kind of growing frustration on the part of vaccinated populations, that they were going to be restricted in their economic and social activity because of this persistent share of the population that remained unvaccinated, was kind of too much to hold. And so in Ontario and now Alberta, irrespective of what they're calling, we essentially have, from coast to coast, the system of vaccine passports. And let me just say, I think that's a good outcome. It's just regrettable that it's taken this long.
Right. With the exception of Saskatchewan, I think they're the only holdout at this point, but we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and months, depending on, I think, their COVID case numbers. Sean, let's shift the conversation a little bit, but sticking with politics. As I mentioned off the top of the show, we are just 4 days away from the federal election. Most polls have the Conservatives with a very slight edge over the Liberals, but that appears to be tightening. And no matter how you look at it, it is a tight race. So I want to dig into what a potential Conservative or Liberal government would mean when it comes to fiscal policy. There's a great Scotiabank economics report from Rebecca Young that digs into the differences between the Tories and the Liberals in terms of budgets, deficits, and debt. And she said there's been a, quote, great convergence on policy positions across party lines with a bias towards spending. That's something we have discussed several times on the show. Now, as you can see from these charts, this first one from Scotiabank on budgetary balances, there is a slight difference between the Conservatives, which are in blue, and the Liberals in red. There's also that dotted line is the PBO, the Parliamentary Budgets Office estimate. But they do, it's not, you know, a worlds apart, and it's even closer when you take a look at this next chart over here, and that's looking at federal debt. Doesn't seem to be much light between the Liberals and Conservatives here. Now, as Scotiabank's Young noted, the author of this report, that any differentiation between party planks on the bottom line is largely negligible. Sean, when you look at these charts and how the election has shaped up, how do you think fiscal policy has played into this campaign?
I think it's essentially a non-issue for precisely the reason that this report illuminates. That, you know, go back to 2015, for instance, the first election that Mr. Trudeau and the Liberal Party was elected. This was the subject of differentiation. The Conservative Party and the New Democratic Party were broadly committed to the goal of balanced budgets. And the Liberal Party at that time committed to running the short-term deficits for 3 years in the name of stimulating economic activity. But, you know, it's fair to say in the subsequent 6 years, this issue has ceased to be a major source of differentiation. And as Rebecca Young observes in this report, it's now the subject of convergence. And what's interesting, Alicia, is that it used to be a subject of convergence in the 90s and early 2000s in the direction of balanced budgets. And So, you know, I think it's a kind of interesting that really in the matter of about 20 years or so, we've gone from a broad consensus in Canada at the federal level in support of balanced budgets and limited spending growth to in 2021 after the fall of the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. And now, of course, the pandemic, we seem to have a new consensus in favor of higher rates of spending, ongoing deficits and debt. And for that reason, these issues have loomed less in this campaign than they have in past ones.
We also spoke previously on an earlier episode about that moment when Trudeau had answered a question from a reporter regarding the Bank of Canada mandate, and he said something along the lines that he was not concerned about monetary policy. We had said at that time that we hoped that this would lead to actually a discussion about it on the campaign trail, but it didn't really come to fruition. Do you think there's been a missed opportunity in this campaign to discuss these fiscal policy issues through this election?
I think the short answer is yes. You know, this campaign started without a kind of identity. It wasn't entirely clear what the so-called ballot question was going to be. You know, at one point it looked like, would it be a competition of ideas about a post-pandemic recovery? I'm afraid, Alicia, in the end, it seems to have devolved into skirmishes on hot button issues like abortion and guns and so on. And in that sense, certainly missed opportunity to deal with some of these big structural questions, including aging demographics and what that's going to mean for public finances, including, of course, our healthcare system, you know, growing concerns about inflation, Canada's place in the world. I note, for instance, that yesterday the American government signed a new security agreement with the United Kingdom and Australia that we're not part of. So, you know, there's a lot of big things happening in the world. And, you know, regrettably, I think this campaign has focused on a lot of relatively small yet kind of galvanizing issues for partisans at the expense of addressing some of these big, more structural and secular challenges.
Yeah, I recall when the Liberals first called this election back in August, Liberal Party leader Justin Trudeau said that Canadians deserve a chance to decide who should lead the country out of this pandemic. But as you say, it doesn't seem clear that that was the ballot box issue this time around. I think it's fair to say, too, that the election has not shaped up in the way that Trudeau had expected it to. When you look at the last 33 days of this campaign, do you see a key issue that has emerged, or what have been the issues that we have been focused on?
You know, for me, it's the expression of anger and frustration on the part of voters, which is reflected in both the ongoing protests that have followed Mr. Trudeau, and of course, the higher levels of support for the People's Party than most of us anticipated. One of the things I do, Alicia, besides joining you each week, is I'm involved in a project called The Hub, which people can find at thehub.ca. And on Monday, we released some exclusive polling that asked Canadians whether they thought the pandemic was going to get worse or better in the coming weeks and months. And what struck me is 47% of respondents said they don't know. I think we underestimate those of us who are able to work from home, whose lives have been relatively unaffected by the pandemic and the accompanying public health restrictions and so on. I think we underestimate the impact that uncertainty has on people's lives at a kind of practical level, but also at a psychological level. You know, you get the sense that people have had enough, that they feel like they've kind of lost control of their lives. And I think that anger and frustration has been expressed throughout this campaign. And whoever ultimately wins the election, I think there will be an onus on them to try to provide a degree of certainty and direction about where we're headed in the immediate context of the pandemic. But then beyond that, I mean, it's something that Mr. Kenney noted in the clip that you played earlier, that there is a demand for certainty out there, and that governments like his have failed to give that to people. And so I guess just in sum, I would say, if you know, I think when future historians look at this campaign, I think the main issue will be just what an angry and frustrated lot we are. And to be fair, I think there's various reasons why we ought to be angry and frustrated. And I think there's really an onus, as I say, on policy leaders, on politicians, to be more responsive to those concerns before they really get out of control.
So how do you begin to address that uncertainty that people are feeling? What should step one be for whatever party ends up winning this election?
I think the most kind of important step is, to the extent possible, to lay out some clear metrics around when we can envision the economy and society being fully reopened. That you know, you get the sense that politicians are reluctant to do that because you know, if there's mistakes along the way or if those targets aren't met, they'll face political fallout. The problem, of course, is that essentially outsources that uncertainty onto households and businesses and families. And, you know, we still don't know, Alicia, when major companies in Canada are going to return to work. You know, if you go downtown Toronto right now, most of those towers are still empty. And, you know, can you just imagine what that means for those workers? They don't know about their childcare arrangements. They don't know about their child's education. There's just so many ways in which I think we've underestimated the burden that this whole experience has placed on people. And I think this election campaign has, in a way, been a way for people to kind of express that anger and frustration. And, you know, the fact that the People's Party is polling as high as 10%, according to some national polls, is really, I think, a reflection of this issue.
And I do think you've seen the messaging from all the parties except the Liberals about why are we having this election campaign in the first place really resonate with people, which is probably something that Trudeau was not thrilled to see. But Sean, I do want to discuss an economic issue that has come up this week. We've been talking a lot about the inflation, and that has been a dominant topic on the campaign trail as well. We got some new data this week about Canada's inflation rate. Statistics Canada said the consumer price index increased 4.1% in the month of August when compared to the same time last year. It's also the fastest pace since March 2003 and an increase from last month's jump of 3.7%. Prices increased in 7 of 8 major components, including real estate. And economists also noted that the increase is being driven by reopening pressures and supply chain issues. For example, car prices increased 7.2%. There are many supply chain problems and production issues hitting the automotive industry these days. Now, this unsurprisingly made waves on the campaign trail. But Sean, when you look at this data, what are some of the things that jump out to you?
Well, let me just pick up on something you observed about the extent to which this inflation is being driven by supply issues, because I think one of the ongoing debates we're having, not just in Canada, but around the world, is whether this rise in inflation is a result of accommodative monetary policy and fiscal policy, or whether it's a function of some of these supply chain issues. And of course, it's not a binary choice. It's no doubt some combination thereof. But I think what the data showed this week is that those who are arguing it's principally as a result of government policy are probably overstating their case. That these ongoing supply chain issues are having a greater effect in terms of price inflation than we probably understood. I mean, you mentioned cars. You know, I hate to use mere anecdotes, but when you talk to people who work at dealerships, the problem isn't demand. You know, in fact, they've been surprised mm-hmm. that even through the pandemic, people are coming in and prepared to purchase new cars. It's that they don't have much in terms of diverse supply on the lot. And so that necessarily has impacts on prices. And so I guess that's a long way of saying that those critics who've seized on the spike in inflation as an indictment of monetary and fiscal policy probably need to recalibrate their argument a bit and at least acknowledge the role that the supply chain disruption is playing in producing these inflation numbers. And the reason why that's important is because, you know, it gets to the heart of the question is this a transitory inflation that will kind of work itself out as those supply chain issues are resolved? Or is this something more structural, in which case, you know, we could be in for some serious challenges even as we come out of the pandemic? I think that's the big question that we need to try to answer.
Definitely the question of the post-pandemic recovery. We're also seeing it in regions around the world, including the U.S. They have saw a spike in inflation. I believe it was 5.1% from their most recent data. But economists were saying this is due to fiscal stimulus, and so that the high inflation won't last long. You know, a Bloomberg report cited one economist saying that the U.S. was an outlier because of the fiscal stimulus that has been injected into the economy. Canada is obviously a different market, but is this something that, you know, policymakers, how do they respond to this? Or is it just a matter of keeping a close eye on it and hoping that the numbers improve over time?
Well, the only thing I will say is that I do think that Tiff Macklem and the Bank of Canada have some responsibility in terms of articulating a plan to return to something resembling a more normal monetary policy. So, you know, I talked earlier that one of the reasons we have so much uncertainty in our economy and society is that there's been a reluctance on the part of policymakers to communicate a bit of a path forward, even one that, you know, may not be perfect. And I think the same onus lies with the Bank of Canada. The bank monetary policy over the past 24 months has been extraordinary, purchasing up, you know, billions of dollars in government bonds and so on. This is obviously extraordinary policy that can't become ordinary. And, you know, for that reason, I do think, you know, I'd like to hear more from the bank about what the conditions would have to be for it to start to hold back on some of those activities and return to something closer to a normal policy approach.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we wrap up the show, I do want to quickly chat about one part of the industry which was really tied to this inflation conversation as prices just skyrocketed like crazy, and that is lumber. North American lumber prices hit record highs back in May, reaching $1,600 US, which was triple the cost before the pandemic hit. As you can see here in this chart, the peak that happened in May, and we are safe to say that the prices have crashed back to earth. Now, the lumber price saga has been fascinating because the pandemic made the situation so volatile. The price jumped so much earlier this year, in part because people were stuck at home and decided to take on home renovation projects, build a new deck, what have you. So what do you think this specific example of the lumber price fluctuation shows about the impact that the pandemic is having on various aspects of the economy?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, a big part of this, of course, was the spike in demand because people's balance sheets had improved and they were stuck at home. You know, this is totally speculative, but part of me wonders if part of the adjustment is a function of the challenge it has been for people to hire residential construction workers, tradespeople, because of this spike in demand. You know, if in effect there's been a kind of self-correction caused by labor shortages in some of these skilled trades, which is something we've also talked about in the past, Alicia, that you know, that there's this kind of tension between the spike in demand for this type of labor at the same time that we're seeing pretty significant labor shortages. I think, incidentally, that kind of structural issue is going to be with us for some time, and we're seeing data not just in the skilled trades, but across different occupations and industries where labor shortages are starting to reemerge after the you know, after the temporary increase in unemployment. So that's a long way of saying, you know, setting aside the specific conditions around lumber, I think we're returning to something resembling a more normal labor market, which means that labor shortages are going to be returned as, you know, one of the most important issues facing our economy.
Certainly. And Sean, I would like to dig more into that, but that is all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for the conversation once again.
Thanks, Alicia.
Now, if you want to rewatch this episode or get more news about the COVID-19 pandemic, please visit the Yahoo Finance Canada website. And if, for more bonus content, please make sure you check out our podcast on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you have any questions for Sean or feedback about the show, please feel free to email me. I'm at Alicia at yahoofinance.com. Thanks for watching.